Accession number 16808, Rule 24.
Red Spittle's Rule 24.
If you get a premature shell, they have a drill for it in the gunnery schools, and that is that the gun must not be fired again until it's examined, because it need not be the shell itself that's the trouble. It could be something to do with the firing mechanism, the pin, or something or other. So anyway, I flips it in the correct drill fashion, and much to my surprise, that it went straight off. Terrific bang, the breech recoiled, and my hand was flung up to the ceiling, because the gun, if it's on a reasonably level angle, the barrel, it actually, fortunately, it was slightly pointing upwards above a level position, slightly up, and which was a good job it was. And I flipped it in. The gun went straight off instantly. My hand was flung up with the recoil of the gun and wrapped the ceiling, as you might say, the roof of the turret. And I had several blisters on my knuckles where it had wrapped the top of the ceiling of the turret. But of course, I'm actually totally stunned. I thought, Christ. And my mind registered what had happened, but it seemed a long while before it communicated itself to my common sense, as though there was a distinct sort of a gap in my brain somehow, because one part told me I'd had a premature shell, and the other part told me something had gone wrong. Anyway, loading it correctly, which was as I've described, loading the shelling with two hands, supporting it with the left hand once the nose is in the base of the barrel, your right hand comes over the top, as if you're going to start doing an overarm swimming. Your right arm comes over the top, your forefingers go on the base of the shell, and you take it straight in with your fingers and your hands straight into the barrel. And up comes the block, and then the gun should be ready to fire. In this case, it was a faulty shell, and it automatically fired. And I thought, Christ. Anyway, after what seemed a long, long time, in seconds I suppose, but it seemed I sort of came back to earth, and I climbed out of the turret, and I noticed that there wasn't a soul about. The street was empty. And of course, when this shell went off and went up the street, everybody ducked and dived for cover. And what had happened, being that it was slightly raised, the barrel, it was slightly elevated, about 300 or 400 yards up the street, it had taken the first floor of a cafe, straight out. It hit this cafe, the corner of the building, and of course it exploded, and blew it clean out. Well, everybody, as I say, was a dive for cover when this explosion came. Firstly, they got the gun went off, and the next minute there's a terrific explosion where the HE shell hit this building, and the building blew out, and of course everybody died for cover. Anyway, I climbed out, and Bill Barnett, my co-driver, had got the Bren gun on the mudguard, cleaning it. Well, when the gun fires and the tank is stationary, obviously the whole tank recoils, and because it was facing at 12 o'clock, as we call it, facing the front, so it sort of virtually sat down on its springs and then came up again. Only a little bit, but it recoils the whole vehicle. And so therefore, he was on the mudguard cleaning the Bren gun. So when the tank recoiled, the gun he was holding obviously moved. So he knew that the gun had fired. And he was the only one, other than me, that knew. Because everybody else who was round the tank, when it exploded, they didn't realise where it came from. And so old Bill said, "Bloody hell, what happened there, mate?" I said, "I don't know, it just went off." And then we noticed people came out from where they'd been hiding. And up the street was a bit of a conglomeration of people on this corner where the shell had blown the building down. Well, it obviously something had happened, and within a minute we weren't verbal things, and it came back to us that somebody had been injured. So, of course, we all goes up to see what had happened. And when we gets there and sort of pushes through the crowd, as it were, all lads, there's this officer lying on the floor, and he's covered in blood. I thought, bloody hell, he's dead. He was unconscious, lying there, literally covered in blood. And the rest of the officers were standing round, and all the different people, the troops and that. And of course, they are sent for the MO or one thing or another. And then the thing is, somebody said, what happened? Somebody said, God knows. It just blew out. So somebody said, well, it must have been a flyover. And that seemed to be the general consensus, that what had happened, we sometimes used to get what was referred to as a flyover. And what it was is somebody, somewhere, had got a shell in a gun without a target. And they thought, I'll just fire it anyway, knowing that it would land amongst the enemy or in their area. Even if it dropped in the middle of a field, it would still be in enemy territory and not your own, you see. And I suppose both sides did it. And because we noticed it when the Germans did it, because we had a stray shell land, which wasn't followed up by any more, you see. When one lands, you don't know whether it's a marker for some more to come or not. Well, if nothing else follows, you just refer to that one isolated shell as a flyover. Yes, that's the general technical army term at that time. So the general thing was, they said, it must have been a flyover. Well, that was the thing. And the only other person injured was a chap who had been sitting on top of one of the 17-pounder Shermans, and a bit of shrapnel had hit him in the thigh, which apparently the MO dealt with. Well, this officer was taken away, the MO and that, and things, we all went back to our vehicles and all that. And old Bill said, we're the only two who know, Reg. I said, yeah, so it looks like. He said, well, I shouldn't say anything. Leave it, you know. Because it seemed as though they'd accepted that it was a flyover, you see. Anyway, I was added on my conscience a little bit, because I always remember what my father used to say. A secret is only a secret when only you know it. It's not a secret when you tell someone, because they can tell someone. And two of us knew, me and Bill Barnett. So I said, well, no, I said, I can't do that, Bill. I said, firstly, it was on my conscience a bit, that, you know, because we realised he wasn't dead, but he looked as though he was dead, covered in blood. Anyway, there was a sequel to it. I met him in Berlin later. And I said, no, I better tell old Ginger what happened. Just, that was the major, Ginger Gillespie. No, he said, Pete, what? No, they don't know, Reggie. He said, God, he said, I'll be out of trouble, he said, if you tell them. I said, yeah, well, that's no good, Bill. I said, in any case, I said, you know. Yeah, well, I shan't tell anybody, he said. I said, well, I know you won't, I said, but a bit later on when you had a couple of pints, you might. No, I said, I better tell him. So, of course, it goes up the road and, excuse me, sir. He said, yes, Corporal. I said, about the flyover, sir. Yes, he said, bloody bad business, he said. I could have done without that. And I'm not sure, but I think this captain was their second squadron, second in command. Yes, old Ginger said, yeah, bloody bad show that, he said. Bloody nuisance. I said, well, I'd just like to explain, sir. I said that it wasn't a flyover. What do you mean, he said. So I explained, what had happened, you say? He was bloody furious. God, I think he took all his control to stop him hitting me. I think for two pins, he'd have smacked me one. Anyway, once I'd owned up to it, it meant a court of inquiry. I mean, even in wartime, back going on, you still got to have these things done properly, you see. So the first thing was, they sent for the armourer. He went down and inspected the gun, inspected the shell case. And I said, what do you think? And he said, no trouble there, Corporal. He said, it's a premature shell. He said, just a bit of bad luck. He said, you're bloody lucky, mate. I said, what do you mean? Well, he said, all you got is a couple of blisters on the back of your knuckles, he said. If you'd have been loading that like they do in action, he said, you'd have had your bloody arm off. And I never gave it a thought till then. You see, Bill Baggerly, loading regularly and consistently, it's very arm aching to load the shell correctly and deal with it correctly, and awkward to do it, especially when you're looking after a warning set. So what they used to do, the gunners, the loaders, the operators and the loaders, they used to lift the shell in with two hands, put the nose in, and then instead of putting the right, still holding with the left hand and putting the right hand over to push it in the shell, I took the right hand away and just pushed it in with the left hand, which was already holding the base of the shell, which meant that it took the forearm inside the shield of the gun. Now, if he'd have done that with that shell, he'd have had a shattered arm and shoulder with the explosion and the recoil of the gun, because his arm would have been inside the shield. That is the way the gunners in action, well, not the gunners, the wireless operators who load the guns, that's the way they load them. They don't do it as per drill at Aldershot. They do it wrong, because it's simpler and quicker and easier and not so hard work. And his arm would have been inside that shield, and Bill Bagley would have lost his arm if he'd have loaded that shell. So there was a good side to a bad side, but it still meant the court of inquiry, and which they had later, and a day or two later, they fetched me, come up in a jeep and collected me, and took me away, and we went into this farm, room in a farm. There was a table there, and three or four officers, and we got a young officer who I never knew, second lieutenant or something. He was supposed to be my friend. I call him friend. He's supposed to be my friend. And he was put in my case, you see. And the armourer was there. And that was, really, it was a formality, you see, because although you always assume that the authorities in a circumstance like that look on it as though you're the villain and we're going to do you. So that was the feeling when you went into the room, you see. And anyway, they told me to sit there, and I sat there, and my friend sat the side of me. The armourer was over the other side. The case was read out with all the pomp, and such as it was. And the major said, "What have you got to say?" And I had to go through my emotions, how it happened, and describe the incident. And then, of course, finally, the armourer is asked his opinion. And he said, straight away, you see, he said, "There's no case to answer." So he said it was purely a premature shell. I inspected the gun was nothing wrong with the gun, it was purely a bad shell. And that was it, you see. But I didn't like it, you see, because I'd not had an officer at a time when you didn't want to lose officers, you see. Anyway, that was that. So the war went on. Well, the Arnhem thing settled down, the Americans went away. The Queen's Regiment, who were our infantry, came up. The Rifle Brigade came up. And the war started to assume a normal appearance, you see. Now, we set out then northeast towards a place called Sertogenbosch, which is a very important town, because there's a canal, a big canal there. There's a railway there and a junction of roads. So it is a good centre of communications, you see. And of course the Germans were holding it. And that was our target, objective, like, you see, of our particular squadron. And eventually we get out into the country, you see, and that's where this episode of this second shot of my gun was done, at this time, on our way out to Sertogenbosch, when he knocked out this anti-tank gun. And we're progressing nicely, and we still got our four Cromwells, you remember, the four of us, troop officer, two sergeants and me, troop corporal. And the leading troop of the column, because by now we'd become roadbound, you see, we couldn't go out in the country. You couldn't sort of, the squadron leader couldn't deploy troops left and right in the country, you see. They had to be, if he wanted to have a troop on his right, there had to be a road there, or a farm track of some sort. There had to be solid ground. You couldn't go in open country, because you just bellied the tank down and that was it. You had to get the Remy up to get you out again. So we were basically roadbound, you see, which made it bad for us and good for the enemy, because they knew where you got to come. Anyway, we're going on, and the leading tank was knocked out. Unusually, it was the troop corporal's tank of the leading troop. Well, the roads being awkward as they are, the normal practice would have been for the troop behind, or the reserve troop, to have taken the lead. But the roads were very reasonably narrow. You've got trees lined either side, spaced nicely, spaced out at even distances. And at the time, they'd been lopped, like you see these trees. They cut them for the like baskets and things with the branches, so that you get like a tree trunk with a knob on the top. You see, and that at that time, that was the appearance of them, evenly spaced out both sides of the road, and a dike each side, you see, behind the tree was a dike. And the dikes at that time were dry. Although we'd had a lot of rain, they were still dry. Well, we call them dry. At least it wasn't full of water. And they're about, can be up to 8 feet deep, you see, in Holland, because they're very good on that, because of the floods. And it's awkward for a whole troop to get past. So my troop leader, and I never forgave him for this, because old Bill Bagley, my operator, comes up, and we're sitting there, you see, knowing that this leading tank's been knocked out on the radio. And Bill Bagley gives me a kick under the gun, and I lift me one side of my headset, and I said, "What's up, Bill?" He said, "You'll know in a minute," he said. "We've just been volunteered." So I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Troop officer just come up on the radio and volunteered to lend the leading troop air tank." See, being junior tank, troop corporal, if he's going to lend one, it's going to be me, you see. So consequently, I'm instructed to motor up and take the lead with the leading troop, you see. So I goes up and we pushes this knocked out tank to one side so everybody can get by. And we carries on, you see. And I wasn't very happy because this troop leader, who was a sergeant actually of this troop, the leading troop, and he was an old desert man. And matter of fact, he was made up in the field later on to be a lieutenant, became an officer in the field. And he got a terrific reputation in the squadron. It was a sort of a byword in the squadron as for efficiency and reliability, getting the job done and all that, you see. He was like a god, as you might say. And so I gets up there and we start operating main front. Well, his idea of movement was entirely different to all the training that I'd ever done under the circumstances that we were in. And what you find in Holland was the roads would go dead straight. And then they'd turn at a certain angle and go dead straight again for, say, a quarter of a mile or perhaps half a mile. And then it'd come a turn and it'd be straight again. And there's all these straight zigzag roads going across the country. And in training, we always trained that the leading troop, when it approached a corner, would go up to the corner, and before he went round it, the following tank would come up behind him, and if it was a right-hand corner, he would come up to him on the left-hand side so he could see slightly past him, so that if when he went round the corner, if he was fired at, the second tank could probably see what had fired at him and be able to be in a position to reply. Well, this sergeant's idea was entirely different to that. So I gets in front and we starts moving up. Colin gets on the move again. I gets up to this first corner and taking stock. And I looks back and he hadn't moved. He was still there. I thought, bloody hell, you know, perhaps I shouldn't have moved. You know, perhaps I shouldn't have drove on or something, you know. I waited, nothing happened. So I came up on the B-set and I said, "Hello, Abel." Well, I'd have called him Sunray, because although he was a sergeant, it would have been Abel normally. He was troop leader, so I'd have called him Sunray. I said, "Hello, Sunray, something wrong?" He said, "He'd come up," and he says, "Hello, Baker, press on, out." I thought, press on? pressed on all bloody ready. I'm on my own as it is. So I said, I come up and I said, I never say it again. I said, hello, Sunray. I'm waiting for support. He called back, gave me a mouthful of foul language. In other words, called me a shitter and everything else. He'd get a bloody move on. So I thought, oh, well. So I pushed on up the road further. And then I looked back and they was getting on the move, you see. The column started moving. He came up. And when I gets up to the next corner, he come roared up to me. Jumps out of his tank, climbs on the back of my horn, give me such a roasting, called me every, you know, thing, as though I'd never had a father in my life. And I told him the same back, you see. I told him, I said, I can understand now why you live so bloody long, I said. As far as I'm concerned, you're a bloody shitbag. I said, you're supposed to be up behind me. I said, if you can't be up behind me, I said, get some other blader up there. I said, I'm not trying, I said, to go out on a bloody limb like them, I was be on my own. Anyway, he was all for punching me in the ear, he was, and anyway, we progressed very unhappily, I'm going to say, the rest of the day. And we spent the night. We went on the next day. And I think he'd begun to realise that if he didn't behave himself a little bit, I might not be so kind as to keep doing what I was doing, and that I might do something stupid, like coming up on the A set and asking where the bloody hell he'd got to. Which would have meant that everybody in the squadron would have heard, you see. Which would have been a bit derogative to his character. So he started to behave himself a little bit. But anyway, we went on. And of course, by now, we're sort of the end of August, the end of September. You see, the Arnhem thing is completely finished. And we are now back in a normal war situation, you see, with a proper objective, which was Sir Toganbosch. And we eventually comes up to a junction. And there's amusing things happen, little comical stories come in, you see. And there was this big farm down this track to the left as we were facing front. It was like a T-junction, you see. The air road went straight on, then there was this track off down to this big farm. Well, we gets to it, and I stops. Because I was waiting to see whether he wanted me to carry on or do anything. I thought, he wants somebody to have a look at that farm, and I didn't know whether he wanted me to go and look at it, you see, so I stopped. And up he comes, and he says, hello, Baker, you better go down and have a look at that farm, says it's all right. So I go down the farm, you see, in my tank, of course. I go down the farm, it was a big farm, spread out. And it goes around the back of it, and that could put me completely unsighted to the rest of the squadron, you see, back of this farm. And looking round, just generally, and suddenly the door opened, and out come who, to me, were an elderly couple. I mean, they were probably about knocking on for 60. And when you're sort of 25, they're old, you see. Now I'm 83, of course they're young, but anyway, this elderly couple come out, you see. And we've been used to this now ever since the same, basically. We got used to this. Out they come with the tray and the wine and the strawberries and the cream. And we're indulging, you see. And about 15 minutes goes by. Up comes an air troop leader and says, hello, Baker, what the bloody hell's happening around there? So I answered him, I told him, I said, we're having a discussion with the local farmer. I said, he's given us some details about enemy positions and tackle and equipment sort of thing. So he says, yeah, well, hurry up and get back, he said, when I get on the move, he said. I suppose the squadron leader had been up when they know why the column had stopped, you see. So I said, we thanked him very much in all this and the other, you see. And we're going to get on the move, you see. And as we sort of started up, ready to start a move again, this farmer suddenly become excited, saying, oh, sort of wait, indicating he wants to wait a minute, you see. Now, you probably know that when you get these big cellars on these farms, they have big doors that are slightly sloping, but you open them up and there's steps that go down under the building into the cellars. And he goes to one of these doors and lifts one of them and shouts down the cellar, you say, to something. And honestly, to put it clearly, on the other ship myself, I was 7 SS Germans came out of that cellar. They could have started a war on their own. The equipment they'd got a lot. Automatic weapons, bazookas, everything. I thought, God. I mean, we were totally helpless to defend ourselves against the situation. But they wanted to surrender. They wanted to give themselves up because the country was so flat, they could see, you could see for miles. And they obviously thought and realised that their chances of survival were going to be very slim with the movement of the troops and the situation they knew they were in regarding their own people. And they thought, well, they must have had a discussion. They said, well, we'll jack it in, you see. Well, they didn't leave the stuff down the cellar. They came up with all the equipment. And, God, honestly, bloody hair went up in the back of my neck. And he went up. So I said to Bill Bagley, I said, have a word, quick, you know, to these Jerrys. And, of course, speaking French, them being in occupation all this time, they'd obviously been in France and that, and they picked up words. And so we got them to understand that to lay the weapons down, you see, so they put all the kit down and we searched them and to make sure they hadn't got any concealed grenades or anything, because what these, the SS, the Hitler Youth, especially, when we used to search them in Normandy, they used to wear a kind of a jockstrap inside the trousers. And they often used to carry like 2 grenades, hand grenades, in the groin. The idea being that when they were captured and took prisoner, in a very hurried manner, they would be sent to the rear, and they would be got 2 grenades, which were what they thought was a reasonable chance of using them to the best effect. They would use them, you see. They were that fanatical, these Hitler Youth blowers in Normandy. Right, maniacs they was. And so we searched them, you see, and everything, made sure they were disarmed. And we got all the weapons and everything that they'd got. We thought, well, we can't just leave them. So we laid them out in a line and then got them to climb. They sat on the back of the tank, which a Cromwell is ideal for, because it's flat at the back. They sat on the back of the tank. And when we went forward, of course, we ran over all the equipment that they'd had and destroyed it, you see, made it unserviceable. Because as soon as these came out and I'd sort of come back to Earth, you know, I mean, Christ, I was about 10,000 feet up in the air when these walked out of this cellar. And realising the situation that we were actually in, like, we were at a total disadvantage. I called up on the radio and reported that we actually got 7 prisoners, you see. So we took them back and that made the day for their, my sergeant, troop officer. He was, of course, he reported it and all that, and I suppose that was another feather in his cap. I don't think I was mentioned in any way, you know, what we'd done. He just reported that the troop had got 7 prisoners, their SS, you know, very important people. And so that we went on from that, you see. Well, then we got up a bit further up the road, and in the distance we could see Setogenbosch with your binoculars and that. You could see traffic going up and down the roads in the distance, like down a fens in England, you see. And we come to a place where there was like a conglomeration of buildings. It might have been like a biggish farm with 2 or 3 cottages aside of it. And it was a wooded area, strangely enough. On the right-hand side of the road beyond it was a sort of a wood, like a copse. And the Germans had felled a tree. It was a big tree, a really big tree, laid across the road where all this conglomeration was, you see. And they made it, had turned it into a strong point. They hadn't got nothing there heavy, I mean, otherwise had a sort of anti-tank, nothing like that, so they bumped us off straight away. And at this time, we were working with 2 sections of infantry up the front. And they were walking in the dike with a section either side of my tank. And we'd been doing this all the way up this road, you see. after I joined them, this infantry appeared, and we had a section that's like about seven men, with an NCO, I suppose, of some sort. And we had a section either side in the ditch. It was me up on the road. And as we're going slowly forward, they were walking forward, level with us, you see. And we got up to a point where there was a cross track, and this conglomeration in front with the tree across the road, which was about, well, 600 yards above